Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. David Matthews on behalf of Mr. Cooper. I'll discuss two issues today, the most important issues in this case, both of which should have received careful on-the-record analysis below, but did not. The first is the District Court's decision, without any hearing or specific finding of dangerousness specific to the trial, to shackle Mr. Cooper. The second is the repeated introduction of highly prejudicial evidence of uncharged drug-induced homicides.
I don't see how, in either case, there's any possibility that the jury would have acquitted. So whatever the standard of harmlessness is, you know, with the shackling, whether it's Chapman or something else, I just don't see what chance he had.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. It's particularly given the prejudicial nature of deaths.
No. That's not the point. The point is, the Supreme Court tells us we're not supposed to reverse a criminal conviction as a way of punishing the government for improprieties. We have to find that, you know, there's a significant chance that he would have been acquitted if it hadn't been for the, in this case, the shackling and the death business. But I just don't see it in this case.
As to the shackling, Your Honor, Mr. Cooper is a criminal defendant. He's representing himself. And in this situation, the jury's perception of him is paramount, and we do not know what he could have done. I would concede that
all you say he could have done was walk around, which probably would have frightened everybody. How is that going to get him an acquittal?
Your Honor, I'm not going to disagree that Mr. Cooper, there was a lot of evidence against him.
Well, how would walking around sway a jury?
Mr. Cooper was denied the opportunity to use body language, which is a part of...
Yes, I know, but look, remember, the test is, what would a reasonable jury do? So is a reasonable jury going to acquit a clearly guilty person because of the body language he uses? I don't get that.
We do not know what the jury would have done.
We never know, but we're supposed to say, you know, we're supposed to speculate on how a reasonable jury reacts to whatever is objected to. In this case, chaining him to the desk, so to speak. Now, why would a reasonable jury acquit a clearly guilty person because he walks around while asking questions?
I respectfully disagree with the implication that a jury would presume that he is clearly guilty because we do not know what the evidence would have
been. But that's how we apply these harmless error rules, right? We have to say, is there any chance that a reasonable jury would acquit the guy? And if the answer is no, then it's a harmless error and we can't reverse. That's fundamental.
With respect to harmless error, it is the government's responsibility to prove harmless error. And
okay.
We do not believe they have done that in this case.
Well, what is the evidence that might have, or lack of evidence, or what is it in the presentation to the jury that might have led to an acquittal?
With respect to the overdose death evidence, the single most prejudicial evidence was...
You're not answering my question. My question is, looking at all the evidence that was presented and not presented, what could the jury have fastened on? A reasonable jury could have said, yes, this creates reasonable doubt. There's some hole in the government's evidence or his evidence creates a reasonable doubt. You have to be able to point to that. Otherwise, the error is harmless.
The jury could have chosen to disbelieve the government's witnesses, Your Honor, which is their prerogative.
So essentially you're saying, I mean, you have to go over to your sufficiency argument and the disreputable nature of all the witnesses, which is usually a pretty difficult claim. I mean, you're kind of sliding back and forth between the shackling and the death evidence. And I have to say, I think on the shackling point, you have a real uphill battle because of the things Judge Posner is talking about. You know, if all you can say is, well, he could have walked around, I gather the skirts were the same on the tables on both sides, and the jury never sees the shackles, and it's rather different from a lot of cases. But I wanted to focus on the death evidence, because if you have any claim for prejudice where the jury's just going to say, oh, this is a bad guy, that might be it. But then I come back to the fact that this is really just a case about distributing the heroin. And there's a lot of evidence that he did distribute this heroin. So if the only thing is to say, well, maybe the jury would have thought that every single witness the government put on was not credible, is that the best we can do?
Given the decisions Mr. Cooper made, yes, Your Honor, that is the best we can do and conclude that the jury would have found the government's witnesses not credible. And the reason, notwithstanding the difficulty of making this argument, that we advance this position is precisely because of the prejudicial nature of the
deaths. But you see, that would wash out harmless error. Because it's always possible for a jury to disbelieve witnesses.
Now, I have to say, I mean, were it not for the harmless error rule, I think you would be on very strong grounds to criticize what the government's doing here, because I am at a loss to know, once the statement has been made, you know, I sold heroin to Smith, why the government had to put in evidence that said, and then Smith died of an overdose. You know, I don't get that at all, and I don't think this was, I mean, the government shouldn't do this kind of thing because not everybody's case is going to look like Mr. Cooper's, but we do have harmless error rules, and so I don't want you to misunderstand this discussion as any kind of endorsement, at least on my part, of what the government was up to.
We would agree that the evidence was completely unnecessary given that the evidence was already in terms of heroin. And the reason we would argue that the error is not harmless is precisely because of the highly prejudicial nature of the deaths. What the government is essentially asking this court to do by pointing to all of the other witnesses who testified that Mr. Cooper did sell heroin is to accept the argument that once they poison the well, they can go ahead and add buckets more of good water to the well and erase the fact that it was poisoned. And if that were the case, they would be allowed to introduce...
No, that, in fact, that's the problem. No question about it. Of course, that's the problem.
But you know,
as I say, we're told we're not supposed to use reversal as a way of disciplining prosecutors.
And I guess what we're missing here is anything from Mr. Cooper, you know, to the effect that, you know, he was mistaken for another person, or he wasn't there that day, or he was in prison during the time certain things were happening. I mean, you hear that a lot. I mean, sometimes there are actual arguments where the jury might be so revolted by the fact that all these people were dying from overdoses that they just say, well, let's just convict Mr. Cooper. But it's hard to see that story playing itself out here.
It is hard. The only way that story could be played out is when the judge himself told the jury they could consider the statements Mr. Cooper made when he was attempting to cross-examine witnesses or attempting to do his own direct arguments as evidence.
And which statements were those? I couldn't quite tell from your brief what he was saying that the district court opened up.
There were several times throughout the record where the government would be directly examining a witness or Mr. Cooper would be cross-examining a witness. The witness would say, Mr. Cooper sold heroin on such and such occasion, and Mr. Cooper would say, no, that wasn't me, or the government's witness is lying, statements of that nature, which are agreeably out of line, agreeably not proper procedure, but in light of the instruction and in light of the fact that the jury heard them, the jury could consider them.
Well, why not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could
well,
you...
Why not?
Why not what I...
Why not let them consider it?
The judge did.
So you're not objecting to that. Where are you?
We are not objecting to that as an independent argument. We raised that point with respect to Mr. Cooper's sentence as it demonstrates...
Well, I thought your argument on the sentence... I mean, it sounds to me like he was saying... arguably exonerating things, so you should be glad for Mr. Cooper that the judge let the jury consider it for the truth as opposed to try to restrict him to proper examination or cross. But I thought your argument on the sentence was that the judge enhanced the sentence because of Mr. Cooper's misbehavior at trial as opposed to because of the nature of the acts for which he was convicted and relevant conduct, et cetera.
That is our argument, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. But there's an awful lot of relevant, I mean, on that score, you have a standard of review issue, I'm afraid.
We do have abuse of discretion standard of review on that issue.
His a judge could, I think this judge did, could say that his misbehavior at trial, his general conduct, gave an insight into his character. And his character is relevant to his punishment, risk of recidivism, and so on. Nothing wrong with that, is there?
I would disagree, Your Honor, on the grounds that Mr. Cooper's conduct as trial was part of his exercising his constitutional rights. If the judge had looked at Mr. Cooper's record.
Right. I mean, if you don't plead guilty, that's your constitutional right, but then you don't get an acceptance of responsibility discount.
That's correct.
So what is, I don't get your argument.
Our argument is that because his conduct at trial was part of exercising his constitutional rights.
Yes, I just gave you a contrary example where the exercise of constitutional right leads to a heavier sentence. I mean, what if he says at the trial, look, I believe that I am a superior human being and I have been authorized by God to murder people. He has a constitutional right to say that. You're saying the judge can't take that into account in sentencing him? You can't mean that. You don't mean that, right?
Yes.
No, Your Honor, we would not take it that far. Returning to a question that was raised earlier of the shackles and whether or not they were visible, I would like to briefly mention that question does not go to whether there was error.
Let me ask you, what was the basis of the judge's decision to shackle Cooper?
Your Honor, there is no basis apparent from the record.
Did he object?
No, Your Honor.
Well, who suggested the shackling?
I do not know. The closest thing we can tell is from the judge's entry when we filed the affidavit in this case saying that Mr. Cooper was shackled because he was coming from custody and saying that the issue, there was no specific...
They shackle every criminal defendant who's in custody? Is this a rule? I don't think judges are supposed to have a flat rule of that sort, are they?
No, Your Honor, that's precisely what Deck said.
What's his criminal record?
It's quite lengthy, Your Honor.
with what kind of offenses? I assume you mean more than a dozen traffic tickets.
No,
yes, Your Honor. They include drug trafficking.
But they're violent also.
And not all of them, Your Honor, but some of them have been violent.
Enough of them. Yeah. All right.
But there was no specific finding in this case.
Well, of course there's no specific finding because there was no request for one.
That's correct, Your Honor, but we would submit that under the Supreme Court's ruling in Deck, the standard is not whether there must be a finding if the defendant requests one, but whether there must be a finding if the defendant is going to be shackled.
Why is this any different from prison garb? We know that if the prisoner is brought to the bar in prison garb, he might have a right to appear in street clothes if he objects. But if he doesn't object, the Supreme Court says, there's no error, no need for a hearing, no need for findings. What your right is a right to be tried in street clothes, if that's what you want. Why isn't that the same with shackles? You have a right to findings or to be free of shackles, if that's what you want.
I can't speak to the prison garb cases, Your Honor. I confess I'm unfamiliar with them. In this case, I would say that it is not clear that Mr. Cooper even knew he had a right to appear not in shackles. And with that, unless the panel
Look,
has...
his problem is, he's a wise guy. So he tells the judge, I've studied law, I do this, I got an acquittal, and so on. How do you deal with a person like that? Do you take him at his word and say, all right, you're knowledgeable about law, then I don't have to make any special breaks for you. You've told me you're as good as a lawyer, right?
I understand that Mr. Cooper did say that. That's correct, Your Honor. In this case, we would say that what should have been done is he should have been warned that he would appear in shackles. That is what the only thing we believe that the judge should have done that didn't do.
As part of the Feretta exchange?
Yes, Your Honor. And if the panel has no further questions, I believe I'm out of time.
Of course, what's ridiculous about this is, so you, the judge warns, so the judge says, well, you know, if you represent yourself, you're going to be shackled, and as a result, you're not going to be able to walk around. Whereas if you have a lawyer, you wouldn't walk around anyway, so it wouldn't matter whether you were shackled. And then he says, oh, well, all right, judge, I guess I need a lawyer after all. Then he's going to appeal and say, oh, the judge, he's with the shackles business, he, you know, I really wanted to represent myself, but he harped on the shackles, and I couldn't do this, and so on, so I didn't. That's what you want. Just
and the Court of Appeals would reject it, right?
Yep, we can reject them both.
You can reject them both or accept them both, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Mr. Norwood.
And may it please the Court, I was trial counsel below. I'll first address the issue of shackles, and then I know Judge Wood is interested in the evidence of that, as well as the other members of the panel. With respect to shackling, it is plain air review. The defendant never raised the issue before the district court.
On the parallel to prison garb, it's not plain air review at all. That's the argument that was rejected by the Supreme Court in Estelle against Williams. Said it's not subject to plain error review. The issue is waived unless a request is made in the district court, because the right in question is a right to represent oneself to the jury in a particular way, and the defendant just has to choose by telling the judge how he wants to represent himself to the jury.
I stand corrected.
You may have waived the benefit of Estelle against Williams, that is, waived the waiver by not making this argument.
I think under any set of circumstances, it shouldn't be reversed on this issue. And I think...
Why was he shackled? Is this a rule, or is it based on his record, as Judge Easterbrook suggested, or what?
I am not sure if Judge Murphy and the marshals had some kind of conversations or not, but I know he was shackled for all of his court appearances.
Does the judge have a rule that...
I am not certain.
But you practice there.
I practice in front of Judge Murphy.
Does he shackle other people?
Normally, most of the cases I appear before him involve plea hearings and sentencings, and the defendants are normally shackled, I believe, at their feet, not at their hands.
Right. No, I meant at trial.
I haven't had a trial in front of Judge Murphy since 2001, and I don't recall what happened back then, Your Honor.
So does the government ever ask for shackling, or is that something the marshals just worry about?
I think the government did not request that Mr. Cooper be shackled. I know there are cases. I remember once our office had a case involving three members of the Aryan Brotherhood, and they asked that they be shackled during the trial, but it's not a normal request by the government to the court to shackle somebody during trial. I think what the reality is that if Mr. Cooper said, Judge Murphy, I want to be able to roam around this courtroom freely and act like my own attorney, one of two things would have happened. Judge Murphy would have said, no, based on your criminal history, that of the number of numerous convictions of assault and weapons offenses and drug offenses, as well as the numerous arrests. He's been arrested for murder twice and attempted murder once. Judge Murphy would have said, no, you can either appear before the jury shackled for safety or not. The other alternative would have been to have marshals take up defensive postures every time the defendant moved, and you can't have that because that would be more prejudicial than have him just sitting there.
In principle, I mean, have him in the crosshairs all the time. But
they would have had to do that for the safety.
The defense has not recommended installing Gatling guns in the roof of the district court, pointing down at the defendant, I take it.
Not that I'm aware of.
Mr. Norwood, I would appreciate it if you would move on to the use of the evidence of overdoses, because I really think we've dealt with shackling.
Okay. I want to break it down into two separate categories. One is the Marler brothers. I'm going to use it the Marler brothers, and one is Jessica Alsup. With respect to the evidence of the Marler brothers, that was the evidence of the defendant's own statements to other individuals as to what happened.
But why was it relevant? Why was it relevant to whether he distributed heroin?
The defendant's statements were to other people, and I'm paraphrasing, but I sold heroin to the Marlin brothers and they died.
The Marlin brothers, they died.
Be careful.
Yeah.
Be careful to use this because this is the same stuff the Marlin brothers used. I mean, those kind of statements.
But you could stop it after the first clause, right?
I sold to the Marlin brothers, period. Mm-hmm. I don't understand at all why, you know, unless he's saying, buy my heroin, it's especially good because it kills people.
Well, there is an aspect of that to this case. And the testimony came in from Chelsea Little. It's extremely counterintuitive, but Chelsea Little testified that when somebody falls out or overdoses from heroin, other heroin users seek out that heroin because of their belief it's better.
Right.
So if a person uses heroin normally and nothing happens to them other than a normal high, and then they use heroin and the same amount and they fall out, then other heroin users believe it's better heroin and will go to that
user. But is that, germane
to
his guilt?
Pardon?
It's interesting and actually perfectly plausible, but why does that have to get into the case?
Right.
The government believes that it was the actual statements of the defendant involving his distribution of heroin.
But what if the defendant had also said, and by the way, last Tuesday I robbed a bank? There are things, just because the defendant said it doesn't make it relevant to this prosecution.
And absolutely, and robbing a bank has absolutely nothing to do with a conspiracy to distribute heroin, but distributing heroin.
And why does the after effect of
why the after effect? Suppose he had said, I sold them this heroin and they died because I had spiked it with arsenic. Would that all be admissible? I can't believe it.
Because I spiked it with arsenic?
They died because I spiked it with arsenic.
I still think that it does come in as relevant. Now,
it's the crime of murder. You can't show the crime of murder in order to show the crime of distributing drugs.
Yeah, it's just an 841A1 prosecution.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. It is. And I see the panel disagrees with me. I understand the disagreement.
I thought we had made this clear in the Beasley case, which parties haven't paid much attention to.
Your Honor, I'm perfectly candid. I did not read the Beasley case. I read the Burbel case from a different circuit before the trial, which said such evidence was admissible, and that was the basis for my going forward. I am not.
It's the idea that somehow whatever he says is, I don't know, his adopted statement or something like that, and anything you say can be used against you you keep stressing because it was his statement.
It's his statement about distributing heroin.
But can he object to a portion of his statement?
Pardon?
Can he object to his statement, his statement, just as he could object to the use of someone else's statement?
Why does his statement
make any difference?
They're basically one sentence statements. I understand the court's argument. Or the court's position. I just believe that the defendants, the average person is not unduly surprised or unduly prejudiced by the fact that people die from using heroin.
Well, I want to draw a distinction between your use of it at the guilt stage and then later on at the sentencing stage. Yeah. I don't think I would have any issue at all about the government making it clear that this was a particularly terrible heroin seller because his customers keep dying from overdoses. I mean, it seems to me at sentencing it's a whole different question than it is at the guilt stage in front of the jury.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. And the court may be wondering, why didn't I charge distribution of heroin resulting in death with respect to it? The plain fact is Tyler Moore was the witness who talked about Jessica Alsop. He was in state custody at the time for a drug-induced homicide, which he testified that he was in custody for, that being Jessica Alsop.
It was a boyfriend
of Jessica Alsup, yes, ma'am. Tyler Moore got the heroin from the defendant. They used it. Jessica Alsup died. The defendant then hides the heroin back in the woods, and the defendant comes and retrieves it. And I think the story makes no sense without explaining why what happened. That it's a story that I'm selling heroin for the defendant.
It doesn't make any sense even with the death, unless it was spiked with arsenic or something like that. If you just are thinking about an overdose death, the cause of the overdose death is a misrepresentation of the heroin's purity. Right? The user may think this is 10% heroin and 90% fill, and it turns out to be 90% heroin and 10% fill, and you get an overdose death. But that's no reason to hide the stuff. It's a reason to dilute it or accurately represent its quality. Having arsenic in it might be a reason to hide it.
Well, or if you're being charged with a drug-induced homicide, maybe reason to hide evidence of the crime. Tyler Moore is a 22-year-old, I dare say kid, a 22-year-old young boy who had never been in trouble before in any sense. And he got the heroin from Cooper, injected the young lady, she died. He decides to hide it in the woods and get it out of the house. Cooper then later comes and retrieves it. Well, the story makes no sense if you don't include the story about the quick statement that she died, because for Moore to be selling heroin for the defendant for a period of time, get heroin for the defendant, and then say, I'm going to put it in the woods, you come and get it, that story just makes no sense. The bottom line, the government believes, and I know the court has made references to, I know the court used the word impropriety at one point in disciplining the government attorney. It wasn't with a malicious intent in introducing evidence of these deaths. The government, that being me, thought it was admissible based on Second Circuit opinion. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But it wasn't out of maliciousness or any ill intent. But the bottom line is, the evidence of the deaths is harmless in the scheme of the trial. This was a trial over 3 days, over 600 pages of trial testimony. When you look at that, it's only a few. I tried to calculate it last night, only a total of maybe 2 or 3 pages of actually testimony regarding this. There's a question or two to a couple of witnesses, and then maybe a page from Tyler Moore. It wasn't the focus of the government's case.
Was
we
it
just
mentioned in the closing argument?
I didn't read over my closing argument. I'm sure I did, Your Honor. I'm sure I did. I think that's all I have. If the court has any more questions, I'll be glad to answer it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Mr. Matthews. We appreciate the willingness of both you and your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement.